Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Welcome to the Multifamily Zone, where business meets family. We explore what the entrepreneur life looks like from the family perspective. Now, here are your hosts, Julia and Gino Barbaro.
Hey, everyone. This is Julia Barbaro, host of the Multifamily Zone podcast. I'm here with the co-founder of Jake and Gino, my husband and co-host, Gino Barbaro. Hey.
Another one, Julia, the first. This is the first live stream with my wife. I think we're going to make it happen.
We have a great guest. I'm really excited for this one.
Yes. Let me read the bio here. Okay. Adam Mitchell.
Thanks, Julia.
And you know, I've known Adam for a long time. Mm-hmm. So this is, it's been 2 decades at least. Yeah. He's a 6th degree black belt in the School of Traditional Japanese Martial Arts, and he's 3rd degree black belt in judo. He's built and launched, which is really cool, everybody, the first fully interactive online training resource for martial arts back in 2007. When was that? 2007.
That's right.
Long time ago.
One of the first.
He currently teaches over 450 students out of a 900-square-foot school in Mayapack, New York, where we are right now. Yep. And I know he's got a few things to say about his swords behind him. So without further ado, Mr. Adam Mitchell, welcome to the show.
Yes, welcome, Adam.
Gino, Julia, thank you so much for having me here. It has not only been such a privilege to watch Jake and Gino grow, to be a part of that early on, but to see all the different facets of it come to life. Now, Julia's part of this, and I just saw the newsletter that Rand sent out, and there you are with a new acquisition, and you've got, you know, Gabby and Mike, and it's really like so cool to see. So just to be here and to just learn that this is the first live, it's pretty cool. So hopefully I'm able to deliver some value here for the listeners and the watchers. Before we go anywhere else, for Jake, I just want to point out, Jake, there's a sword back there. That's a samurai sword made in 1802, and a whole wall of swords behind
that's
me, brother.
Right.
So
that is incredible. That's for you. I think that you won that contest. He has a cool sword, but that
he does.
That blows it away. Sorry,
he's stacking up on the axes. He's got a bunch of axes and stuff going on. So, you know, this podcast can go in so many different directions. I definitely want to get into bullying and how to teach your kids to stand up for themselves and how to teach your kids to stand up for others, really, because remember about, you know, seeing evil and not saying anything, then you're being probably part of that evil. But before we go there, give us a background, give us a little bit about your background, how you got into martial arts, how you got really into the internet, because I know you were around there when Al Gore invented it, and you've been really one of the pioneers as far as like getting online. I mean, you have a little studio there, but you reach hundreds and hundreds, and you have this online platform. And I ultimately, what I want to do is get into how to help businesses monetize brick and mortar, how they can monetize and start getting on the internet themselves.
Yeah, well, that's a lot to unpack, but you're absolutely right, Gino. You know, you can't get anything more like tactile, more physical than martial arts, and trying to teach that and not just convey those lessons and to deliver value to students, you know, on the other side of a camera, but also create a business out of it. It's really, it's a whole nother level. And I will admit that it took me over a decade to really kind of get in place. But I'll go back to the beginning, and I'll keep it short. I'm not one to really talk too much about myself, but I started martial arts training really young. When I was a kid, I started doing judo in Connecticut. That's where I got my first start, my first taste of martial arts. I had my ups and downs like most people do through their childhood. I was fortunately able to be brought up by two wonderful parents. But I made some choices on my own that, you know, were kind of like, I wanted to find my own path, carve my own path. I didn't want to follow that conventional path that I was told that I should be on So I hit a lot of bumps in the road, but fortunately, I think that there was some appeal to martial arts. There was certainly something that a lot of young men have, and that's, you know, they want to be able to find a place to funnel the energy that they have, the aggression that they have, the tension that they have. And I was able to do that in martial arts. I'm very fortunate for that. So fast forward a few years and I followed another dream of mine, which is cycling. And that's been right there hand in hand with martial arts. Traveling all over the world by bicycle on my own has been something that I've always done. And I was teaching martial arts when I ended up getting a job at a factory in Connecticut. We moved to Brewster, New York, and I was working at this bicycle factory and high-end mountain bike factory and working the line. I'm on the phone trying to sell bicycles to a bike shop in Boston while we're doing sub-assemblies of bike frames, and I'm doing tack welding while I'm on the phone. So like that was going on. Meanwhile, during my lunch break, I'd cut across the street to the martial arts school and I'd get a class in. And then when it was over, then I'd go back over, I'd teach the kids class. So this was a real kind of hand in hand thing for me. And when I ended up getting away from manufacturing of bicycles, I ended up getting a phenomenal job with the Schwinn Bicycle Company, which I'm sure yourself and everybody's heard of. That lasted for only about 2 years. I worked for Schwinn. But in that 2 years, what I was able to do is I was able to apply a lot of that sort of street smarts that I had, but also having to really figure it out like I did when I was working for a startup bicycle company in the 90s, mid-90s into the late 90s. And I was able to apply a whole different model of sales and communication and working with clients and working with these brick and mortar bike shop owners all over the Northeast for the Schwinn Bicycle and Fitness Company. Well, it would just so happen that I would rise to the top and that my first year there, I was the top performing sales executive for the whole company in the United States. And I was pretty happy about that. And I was pretty happy that I was newly married. And of course I was happy with that. And that my martial arts thing was growing, and I was started to have this class of children I really enjoyed teaching, and that was growing fast. Then what happened was one day Schwinn decided to sell to big box, and they basically pulled their bicycles out of the independent retailers. Now, Gino, you're old enough to remember back when it was Schwinn bicycles and lawnmowers down at Tony's on the corner. Mm-hmm. Well, that Tony's some of those shops have been, around for decades, generations even. And all of a sudden, like that, it vanished for a lot of these independent business owners. And that kind of hit me because I wasn't just going to skip over to another company. I had never been involved in the corporate world. That was my first taste of it. But I decided that I didn't want any more. So I think I was in a very fortunate position where I had something to fall back on. I had a side hustle going on at the time. It was something I was passionate about, but I was also young enough to where I could make that pivot quickly. And I did so in starting my own martial arts school. That grew, ended up opening my own large school in Mayapack, New York. It grew and grew, it expanded. And I wanted to be able to offer something more. I wanted to offer something more unique to the community. So I started a 501c3, a nonprofit, and I started a Japanese cultural arts center and language school here. We did a cherry blossom festival here in Mayapack. I'm sure, Julie, I recall mm-hmm. you and your sister coming
we
to that
there.
One year.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We had taiko drummers and demonstrations mm-hmm. and woodworking workshops and all kinds of stuff. So I was able to actually multidimensionalize this martial arts school, is what most people just consider a regular kind of karate school, into something so much more. And this is kind of important for me to explain because I want to have the listeners understand where my foundation in multifaceting and multidimensionalizing a core business and becoming something very, very different, but remaining true to that core, why it's so important, especially today in the times that we're in right now. So I created this nonprofit because there was a couple of reasons. Not only did I want to serve these different students at different levels, provide exciting alternative programs other than just punching, kicking, grappling, and choking. But I wanted to be a bit more holistic than that. But also what it allowed me to do was I would bring in talents and skills from other areas, such as, like I just said, woodworking or flower arrangement or music and a musical composition. We ended up partnering with Music from Japan in New York City. And we would be the last stop on their tour. I mean, they play Carnegie Hall. They travel all over the United States. And they actually brought that level of classical and contemporary Japanese music to a concert here in Mayapak. We had weekly Japanese ikebana or flower arrangements. So anyways, I'm explaining this because what that allowed me to do was now go to nurseries or gardening centers and say, hey, we've got this program coming up. We need to send our students to a place to buy these flowers. If we give you the list, would you be able to order the flowers and I can send our customers there to purchase from you? Of course they're going to say yes. And I said, well, you know, would you mind maybe putting this flyer up by your cash register up by the door? And they all said yes. So now I have my martial arts school in hardware stores, in nurseries, in music shops, pretty much anywhere you would think a martial arts school wouldn't be promoted, I was there. And then eventually I worked my way into schools and academic programs where I didn't teach martial arts in schools. One of the programs I taught was feudalism in Japan and its effects on modern society. So this allowed me to get in at different levels rather than doing the stranger danger program or self-defense programs. That didn't interest me. I wanted something more holistic, and it truly, truly worked. So that's pretty much where I got my start.
You know, I don't know if many people know this, but you played a huge role in our life because my kids, you were their sensei Adam, you know, so they had such high respect for you. They went in there for years and you taught them for many years. So, you know, the respect there has been amazing. And I just want to thank you for that. But even further than that, you were our original, like you taught me everything about editing, filming, all of that. That was all, I all learned that from you. And it's funny because when I still do it with Gabriella, who now took over, she's like, all right, what did Adam teach you? So we actually keep going back from that. So you play a huge role in the companies that we have. You know, you have an amazing ideas. You have amazing ideas. You get it done. And so I'm very thankful to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That means a lot.
She's the host. You're supposed to ask them a question.
Okay, I'm not done. I thought you had a question.
No, I'm waiting.
Keep
you, girl.
But, Julia.
Thank you. I know you appreciate that. Because my husband would just talk business the whole time. And it's like,
I would. I would. That's why I'm letting you go now.
No, but as you know, as a parent, right, we parent the way that we remember maybe we wanted our parents to be, right? We do take our childhood memories into our parenting. Mm. So you have four amazing children. And I want to know, you know, with you working at the dojo, with you working in a lot of anti-bullying type of classes that you give, how do you bring it home and teach your children? Because sometimes we're so focused about the world around us and we forget that, you know, the people right next to us need us the most. So tell me how you, even like with your sons, how do you teach them differently than your daughters?
Wow. Well, you know, I think I have more of an effect when it comes to this topic specifically, working with communities and groups of children. I have more impact there, believe it or not, than I do at home with my own kids.
It is,
and I think it is, right,
it
Julia?
Is. Absolutely.
I think that comes down to the golden retriever principle, which is they're going to, no matter what you do, you're still going to love them.
Right.
And they know that. And they're trained,
well,
you know,
would
like,
you say
like a
that
dog.
They are allowed to be themselves around you as the father?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think that's important because it's not so much a bad thing when they misbehave around you. I feel like that they're so comfortable being themselves around you.
Yes. I try my hardest to make sure that my kids can come to me with anything. Sure. I don't impress my whether it's my political beliefs, whether it's my, you know, my personal, I try not to push any of that on my kids. And I think one of the problems, and maybe I can speak very contextually to today, Julie, and I'll be interested to hear your feedback as well, but I don't want to talk to my kids about how I support this presidential nominee and you have to also, because what that does is that removes them from critical thinking and therefore it removes them from having a sense of independence and trusting that someone else is going to think for them. And I think that that's really foundational. If we're going to talk about personal protection and keeping themselves safe, is giving them that tarmac for being independent, thinking clearly, thinking critically. Then they're going to be able to identify any of the indicators for escalation of stress or tension, anxiety, conflict, any of that. It's going to make them much, much more sensitive and able to navigate through that than if we remove them from that and we think for them, or we impress on them, or we keep them available to the dialogue and the discussion at the table and the arguments and all this nonsense back and forth about calling this representative this name, or, you know, Kamala Harris is this, or Donald Trump is that. It's like the children are looking to you for leadership and guidance. They're not looking for your political opinion. And this is by no means to call out any of the listeners or any of our audience. But we really, to answer your question, for my own children, is I struggle, and as every parent does, but I have to kind of take a step back and check myself over and over again. Am I allowing my children to have critical thinking? And am I allowing them to be clear, to think clearly and independently, so that they're going to be able to identify things when they need to and I'm not there?
That's so important. We were just talking about that yesterday. You know, I remember being back at school, and there was always this one person in my class that would question what the teacher taught and would immediately get in trouble and sent out of the room. And I remember thinking, well, that's silly. He's just, he wants to know more. He was questioning what you're asking. It's so important that our kids are able to question what we're teaching them and us to give them an answer. And there has to be a discussion, just like you're talking about. And I'm afraid that too many schools out there or parents out there are just not explaining and not giving a real answer. Do you remember we talked about that just yesterday?
So for me, as a parent, I want my kids to have accountability. If they make a mistake, they have to be held accountable for it. I have to be the role model to them. So whatever I'm doing or whatever I'm saying, whatever language I'm using, I know they're going to hear it.
And the language is all from him, if there's bad language.
The good and the bad language. Just remember that, okay? So
the kindness comes from me. No, I'm just kidding.
And I think ultimately, I want to be their role model. So, I mean, if I do have a political party, I'm not going to tell them. I want my kids to be more conservative, lean more conservative. We go to the March for Life every year. So guess what? They're going to lean that way because they're going to be surrounded by those people.
Yeah, but the important part is you explain yourself.
Yes, but I'm not telling them. Yes, but I'm not telling them. So I'm going to live the life that I live, and I think it's a great life. And I think that they're going to be sponges and say, oh, Dad's doing the right thing, and why is he doing it? And I can have that discussion. And obviously, what you said about autonomy, having our autonomy is probably the most important thing. During this whole pandemic, we've lost our autonomy. That's what's going on right now. We don't have the decision to make our own choices right now because it's getting taken away. So that's what happens, you know, when you have a less empowering life. So as a parent, I think you want each, and this is hard because we have six kids or even one, two kids. It's every day battling and having to discuss and having to like describe things. And it's just like, sometimes just like, can you just go do your homework, please? Stop. I don't want to answer the question, but really, if you take the time on the front end, it really pays off at the end. So I think it's really important what you said. You know, you want them to critically think, but you want to be there also to be the role model for your children.
And it's a constant learning lesson, right, Adam?
It is.
From the first child to the last. I mean, we've come such a long way as parents. And I think it's important to be open about that. You know, I can tell you, me and Gabriella, Michael, now Sophia, we all openly talk about all the mistakes we've made and why we have. And I think that's important for them to see it because they're adults now and they could understand it a little bit better if you just, you know, because there's a lot of things that our parents did. We have no idea why, because they never told us why, but we've never asked them at the same time. So it's a good time to start communicating with the kids about mistakes that we made because we're their example. They're learning everything from us and it's so important. But again, we are full of mistakes And that's
Julia, there's two other things I want to add to this when it comes to keeping kids safe and how we as parents, we have a different role than a trainer, let's just say. Right. Maybe I'll get into that a bit later on. Mm-hmm. But there's two other really important things that I feel have been impactful here in my dojo with the children that I work with. But this is also a lesson that I put into my home with my own children. And I'm going to bring Gino into this because he taught me something many years ago that I've always, like, I've used it as an example many times over. And he taught me something great. And the first is making sure that our kids understand the significant difference, the exponential difference between good and great.
Yeah.
And making sure that our children understand that there is a standard that they can achieve and accomplish. And this, Gino, when we were talking one day over 10 years ago about cars and how you were going to buy Gabrielle a Volvo. And I was like, I made a joke like, yo, yeah, I'm going to buy my son an 84 Monte Carlo. And you're like, yeah, but I want my daughter to not just feel protected and safe in the car, but I want her to say, if she goes backwards in a car of lesser quality or comfort, then she's going to be going, she's not going to want that. Right. So you're setting the bar and setting the standard. And also teaching your kids how to keep them financially safe is, I think, maybe 99% of parents don't truly follow through with that as you do. So both of you are an amazing role model to have for that. And it's hugely, hugely important. Now, the second thing is, I feel when we talk about personal protection and safety, is making sure that our kids understand the value, the incredibly huge value and power of forgiveness and teaching them not to say, I'm sorry, because, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, is so cheap.
Yeah.
It's so cheapened today, where we need to teach as parents, if we're able to teach our kids in the intentionality that is behind forgiveness, this will make them incredibly strong, powerful, and positioned for leadership later on, because everyone that they engage with and connect with, when they say they're sorry, then those people are going to know that they mean it. And we have to teach them that once I say I'm sorry, then I'm opening, I'm allowing someone that I've done bad to open, or I've caused pain to, they're opening the door for me to step in and reconcile the problem that I created in their life. Then after that, I want to be able to commit my amends to them and make sure that they feel confident it's not going to happen again, that I'm not going to be that position in their life. I'm not going to bring that pain to them again. And they're going to feel confident to know that this is never going to happen again. That's a process. That's a path that can only be taught by example and by training. Yeah. But if we just accept every, oh, I'm sorry. Hey, yeah. Say you're sorry. That's wrong.
Yeah.
Because we're cheapening forgiveness and we're allowing our kids to just pass, just to get past. With good enough and I'm sorry's, and this is lowering the standard. And if they exist in this space, they're going to have a very hard time, as like going back to what I was sharing before, identifying challenges as they escalate and as they come towards them.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm happy that you brought that up, because the forgiveness is it's almost, we forget to teach about it. So I'm really thankful you brought that up.
So we're at Mass on Sunday, and the priest is talking about cancel culture and how it's really pervasive now, and how we want to cancel everybody and without giving them forgiveness, without giving them benefit of the doubt. We make mistakes. Everyone says stupid things. We're human, right? We're not there to judge people. But it's so, the woke culture right nowadays is just wants to shut you down. And if you make a mistake and cancel you, that's not what we should be teaching our children. We want to have critical thinking. Where did that person coming from? Where did he learn that from? Where did he have that confirmation bias? Whatever that is, don't just go out and shut somebody down. And that's not what we're here as parents to do. We're here as parents to do, why do they say that? What did it come out of, and what can we learn from that? And it's not just cancel somebody out and have your own little safe little bubble where you're, that's not how you want to live in life. Because if that's where you are, that's a sad life, my friend.
You know what he also said this Sunday? He said, we are called to call out evil when we see it. You know, too many times we see something wrong. We see someone getting verbally yelled at, something's going on. And what do? We literally turn the other way and walk the other way. We don't want to get involved, you know, but there's so much we could do and we could avoid, you know, we could make a call, we could speak up, we could help that person out. And that's why I want to go with you, Adam, is that you do or you did have a class in bullying. And I want you to just give us an idea of what you taught. And because I want to reach the kids out there, but also the adults, because we look the other way as adults. Here we are trying to teach our kids to, you know, do the right thing when you see something wrong, to say something. But here we are doing the same thing. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So like conflict communication and teaching children to navigate these situations is something that is, and this is going to sound very sort of like, this is going to sound weird coming from me, a martial arts mm-hmm. teacher, but it's really not something that you can teach from kicking and punching. Mm-hmm. In fact, you can teach a lot of young people to go the opposite direction on controlling cruelty and bullying as it's being directed at you or as it's being directed somewhere else. So oftentimes martial arts isn't that, but it's the outcome of a good martial arts instructor that will help a child navigate those problems coupled with parenting and some of the stuff that we just spoke about. Mm-hmm. Now, back in when, you know, rewind a little bit, but back when I had just started my martial arts school, a lot of the lessons I was teaching the children on the class and on the dojo floor here, I had one particular parent who was a teacher in one of the local school districts. And she said, "Hey, you know what? You're really making an impact on these kids. Would you mind coming in and talking in our school?" This is going back to 2001, maybe it was 2002. And I said, "No, I'd love to." I came in and I went up on a stage and I talked to these kids just kind of like I do every day. And the message, and I'm not patting myself on the shoulder, but a lot of the teachers in the room were just, their jaws had dropped. They're like, "Wow, like these kids are sitting here, everyone's quiet and they're fully engaged." And I guess I had an impact because I got called back again. And then I got called by another school and another school and another school. And then I worked my way up to being asked to be the guest speaker at one of the largest Catholic organizations in the country. And I spoke there, and that was broadcast out to the Catholic schools. So I ended up, of course, getting, next thing you know, over the course of a few years, I'm being called into these schools to speak about bullying. Now, I'm going to take a step back because I don't, and sometimes I get some heat from this, but I have reasons why. I try not to use the word bullying, but I use the word cruelty. Mm-hmm. And for the first couple of years, I was teaching what I taught on the mat, and I was kind of like having fun with it, right? Mm-hmm. And then one profound moment, and forgive me if I get a little emotional here, but one profound moment hit me, and it stayed with me to this day, and it changed everything for me. And this is what I have called the Dwyer effect going forward, is when this one little girl said something to me that completely rocked my world. And students, we were getting ready for class. I think it was October. We were probably about a month and a half, 2 months into the school year already. And I'm checking in with some of my senior kids, some of the kids that were maybe 13, 12 or 13 years old. They'd been with me for a number of years, so I knew they were going to be really honest with me. They weren't going to, you know, they weren't going to tell me any, like, kind of, they weren't going to candy coat anything. And then I had all the other students. And so one of these young men is now a career military man. He's an officer in the Army. The other one got an incredible scholarship to one of the top ranking engineering schools in the country. These are really good, just solid young men. And I asked them, "Hey guys, how's school going? And what are you seeing? Talk to me. Tell me how you're, you know, what are you seeing? Are you seeing any bullying? Are you seeing anything happening at school that's making you feel kind of uncomfortable?" And you know, they said, "Yeah, just kind of the normal things, you know." And that's one of the things, like Julia, what you said is, like, you know, you have to call it out when you see it, especially if you're a martial artist, especially if you've been committing so much of your life to this. Right. This is your lane. It's what you have to do. Mm-hmm. And then I said, "Well, what about the children with special needs at lunch? You know, when you see that one table over there and there's children, yeah." And this one boy, Robert, he said, "You know what?" He said, there's this one kid who, a group of them will walk by and he has a hard time holding a fork. And when the teacher that's with this child is either up to get milk or, you know, get something, or is doing something or working with another child, a group of kids will get up at the right time and walk by and just hit the fork out of this child's hand. And I could see this girl, Dwyer, her face became red, and then her eyes swelled up with tears. And then I asked the other boy, I said, oh, you know, do you see this too? He's like, yeah, yeah, it's, yeah. Some of us get pretty, like, pretty angry about it. What are you doing about it? And we had some discussion, and it went on, and we made some agreements. But after class, this little girl came up to me, tears coming down her face. She said, can I speak to you for a moment? And I said, of course you can. Her name is Dwyer. She goes, please tell me that doesn't happen. She asked, is this true? Does this really happen to children with special needs? And I said, well, yeah, it does, Dwyer. It's very sad, isn't it? She goes, she just couldn't accept it because she was a homeschool child. Mm-hmm. And she explained to me that the children with special needs would sit on their laps. Mm-hmm. Children with special needs were like gold to them. They were protected and taken care of and nourished with love. It was the complete opposite. Mm-hmm. And I too kind of met her emotion, and I was so apologetic at the fact that I did not identify with that. And that said to me right there and then that what I'm doing is completely wrong. Not that it's intentionally wrong, mm-hmm. but that there is a possibility for cruelty to be completely eliminated within communities of children. Mm-hmm. That not only is it possible, but they want it. Not only is it happening, but it's being taught. Those children are being taught to do that. But now Dwyer just introduced me to the fact and to the reality that this shouldn't happen. And it's not necessary. And the only reason it is happening is because you're allowing it to happen. There's no other reason. Mm-hmm. And when she left, after that, I went home and I wrote my journal and wrote. And I had to discover a new way of teaching about how communities of children, this is why going back, teaching it in my home, yeah, there are certain things I can do. Mm-hmm. But really, I have the effect when I work with a core community, I'm able to identify the movers and shakers, the leadership within communities of young people. And that just doesn't mean the cool kids. That means the ones that are the strongest link in a number of different ways and how they can strengthen the entire chain together. And that's what I was able to create. And if it wasn't for that little girl and her honesty, and if it wasn't for her parents and the community that supported those children with special needs, I wouldn't have been able to have seen that.
So that's the problem. See, the problem really lies within the parents. Because if my kids ever did that to a special needs, I would beat the living crap out of my kids. They would not accept that. And Dwyer's parents were the same way. They would say you would never treat somebody like that.
But so at the same time, it's the parents, and especially us, is we're teaching the kids about how amazing these children are.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And that's what I'm like, my point is like that person, that one girl, Adam, in your life who we know so well, and we just absolutely love her whole family. She changed everything. She changed everything about your teaching, you know, your story. And it's so interesting. My point is one person can change so many things by something. If she chose not to say anything, nothing would have changed. And I think that's important. Right. And it's a good message for us that if we see something wrong, she saw something wrong in just a conversation you had, and she said something. And that's very powerful.
That's right. And Gino, I want to connect with your emotion here. And I feel exactly how you're saying. Let me tell you that the dads of those two young men, one of the dads was a top New York City police officer, and the other one, he was here for, I mean, that young man's still here to this day as an adult, graduated college, and his dad is tops, just an incredible man. But the problem is complacency, not to them. They didn't know about this. Yeah. It's the fact that it wasn't shocking enough to the kids that it moves to the top of their priority list, right? It's just, they're used to seeing it in the schools. Yeah. So it's like, oh yeah, that again. Okay, yeah, it sucks. I gotta get to the next class.
It's really weird. I was talking about this with one of my friends years ago, right? And you have mentally handicapped kids nowadays. When we grew up with them, when I was 10, 12, 15 years old, they were just part of the crew now. It was just really weird. So that kid stuttered, or that person was mentally slower. We didn't even see them as a different person. That's the weird thing that I see 30 years fast forward till now. It seems like we're segmented into different buckets, and it's like, okay, this person goes here and that. We didn't have that growing up. It was a weird thing, and I don't remember. So Johnny's slow. Big deal. Come on, Johnny, let's go play baseball. Whatever the thing was. It just really dawned on me as being something completely different. When I was growing coming up as it is now. I don't, maybe you don't see that. Maybe you don't, maybe my wife doesn't agree with me, but really, I mean, like, I don't know. It just didn't make any sense to me years ago.
Well, I think that's really where this homeschool group, they saw them just as another person, just as another little girl, you know what I mean? As maybe, I don't know. But Adam, how did that conversation change what you taught?
The first, sure, I immediately answer that. The first thing is that I was able to identify the importance of time in our life. And I needed to start teaching these children the value of time and the time that they spend with each other and those even less meaningful to them. And then I started to recognize the pain that I was speaking about and the suffering of someone who's a victim is completely wrong. And how what I was teaching was completely wrong. And we as a society, and I don't really use that word society, but I think we're really brought up, built on this model of good guy, bad guy, villain versus hero. And it's just this polar thing. There's these two, and then there's the story before and after and in between. But really what's happening and that we weren't able to identify was that just by seeing Dwyer suffering from hearing the story told me that there's the onlooker. There's the suffering of the onlooker. Mm-hmm. Then there's the suffering of the bully. And then there's the suffering of the victim. And not in any order, but it's an equal triangle. And this needed to be addressed. And too many of these programs of, you know, stop bullies in their tracks, they're very one-dimensional. They're talking about we're talking about children here. Yeah. We're talking about children. We're not talking about adults in the corporate space where accountability needs blah, blah, blah. We're talking about children. I do not know, and I have not met an adult who cannot sit down, take a minute of their time and reflect inward and say, you know what? Remember that time when I wish I would have said something. Mm-hmm. And even if they have to think back a few minutes, they haven't maybe thought about it in 20 years. Yeah. That time affected even the smallest decisions that they've made throughout their entire life. That time affected the whole course of their life in a different path. Had they chose to just sit there and watch it happen. Mm-hmm. Had they chose to stand on the sidelines and just kind of laugh, but yet inside they were hurting. But they had to feel as though because the left and to the right was laughing, they had to as well. Mm-hmm. So then the first thing I had to do was teach kids that when everybody's hands go up, even if you don't know the answer, what do? Put my hands up and just hope I don't get called on. Mm-hmm. That they need to break that. Yeah. Then if you know the answer and nobody else does, and you throw your hand up and nobody else does, what do? Well, you feel like you might not know the answer actually, and you pull your hand down. That needs to get broken. Mm-hmm. So there was the onlooker. There was obviously the pain and the suffering of the victim, but then we failed to recognize why someone chooses to direct cruelty at another person and what that's all about. And I had to go deep on that one. And I had to identify that, look, we don't want that kid to get hurt. We don't want that bully to get hurt. We don't want that child that was sitting at that table to get hurt. But I also don't want those two boys who are almost black belt students who've been with me for 8 years each to get hurt every time they see this and carry that with them for the rest of their life. Yeah. And as their mentor, I'm responsible for that if they carry that baggage going forward when they leave this dojo. I'm also responsible for finding the solution to the tears that Dwyer had that day. And I took that responsibility very seriously. I connected the dots and I created this thing that I call the trauma triangle, which was a formula for addressing the bully, the victim, and the onlooker. Mm-hmm. And when this all kind of came about, I had to sort of really research, how do we do that? And what are some very basic models and formulas that I could present to students or to groups of students to help them understand why does this happen? Well, it's pretty simple. And I think everybody knows what happens. I mean, I'll bet you anything, Julie, if Gina was standing right next to me. Mm-hmm. Gina, let's do it right now. Let's pretend we're next to each other. I have a baseball bat in my hand and I'm choked up about 6 inches on it. I hand it to you. What are you going to do?
Stimulus response. Yep.
And what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I didn't ask you to do it. 100% of the time, I don't even tell someone to grab the bat. I'll hand it to a boy and he'll grab it. And then when I do this, they don't even say, why are you doing that? Or is everything okay? Like, you're going to drop the bat? No, they automatically go to here. And it escalates. It's a law of escalation. It's a very basic thing. When you get into any personal protection, you get into conflict communication, conflict resolution. This is the most basic, most primitive way to communicate to a group of young people why escalation happens. And all you got to do to stop it is to not put your hand there.
Right.
And that's it. Then the next thing was, as I was able to prove to them, 100% of the time, Julia, I would call up a young man up onto the stage. I never failed 100% of the time. No person ever stopped the escalation until we got to the top. But then I would take that, we have these thing called shinai in Japanese. It's a padded sword where you could wallop me on the head pretty good with it. It wouldn't hurt. It'd sting a little bit, but it wouldn't hurt. I would take the biggest, toughest jock in the school and I'd pull him out of the crowd. And I'd hold it with two hands. I'm going to take a step back. No, look, it doesn't hurt. I hit it with his own hands. Don't worry. I want you to hit me in the head as hard as you can. And he'd be like, really? Oh, I'd look at the crowd. The whole crowd would clap. They get up. They laugh. Just look, trust me. Go ahead. You can hit me on the head. Oops. Hit me on the head as hard as you can. I didn't lose you, did I?
No.
Okay. 100% of the time, they would come in and they would go like this. Or they would go like this, or they would stop short. And when you do it enough and you can see the personality type, you know whether they're going to veer left or right, they're going to stop short, or they're going to cut in front of you. But and what this told me is that no young person is wired. They cannot inflict pain on another person just because. So we are designed, we're wired to be compassionate, I believe. After studying violence and teaching people how to break one another for almost all of my life, I can tell you that we are wired for compassion, for forgiveness, and for being able to contribute. And this is the message that I had to them. So I said, so my next thing would always be, okay, so then now that we understand this, we understand why it happens. We understand that it's completely unnatural to do. It's only through social pressure. So then how do we flip that social pressure? And this is what will stop it. Well, we can use a simple example, and I would always use this example of, I would always use this example of being on a bus. And I think we can all relate to that, where if, and I would have the kids close their eyes and imagine yourself sitting on a bus. And there's always this one kid who's getting picked on, getting punched, getting abused. And this one kid sits alone. And I mean, some of your listeners, this may have been them. This may have been one of their children. This may have been someone that they saw every day and didn't do anything to. This is very common. And I want you to imagine how that feels, sitting there watching that day in and day out. Now, if it was one of your children, Gino, you'd probably be dealing with, you know, if it was, you know, one of your daughters when they were young, you'd be dealing with waking up at night, not being able to go to sleep. You'd just be some fears, probably some stomach issues, nerves, some anxiety that you just can't quite, like, why is this happening to her? This isn't right. And she's witness to this. So she's suffering as a result of being witness to this over and over and over again. And of course, there's this child that this is happening to. It's going to cause them to have irrational, impulsive decisions. They're going to bring a lot of hurt and pain home. They're going to be acting very impulsively, lashing out a lot of anger. And then there's going to be the young person who's pressured to putting this, inflicting cruelty onto another person. Why is that happening? But imagine yourself sitting there and not doing anything. And then what I would do is, I would say, I would pick one person out of the crowd and I would go over and over again. You're seeing this happen. The child's crying. You get up off the bus. How do you feel? How are you carrying that with you into the next day? How does that feel? Do you remember it? Do you recall? And the kids would all nod. And I'm trying to connect this feeling and this true, true, true emotion that we've all felt. And then I said, how many of you are going to stick up for this person? And everybody kind of looks around. And then I have one kid stand up. This one kid stands up and says, stop. And then what do you think is going to happen after that? Then another kid and another kid. and another kid and another kid. And now, what happens to the victim? Well, to the victim, the cavalry's just arrived. To the victim, they're lifted. They're now empowered. They feel recognized. They feel valued. And the person who stood up first is now in a position of leadership. The person who's being the bully, it's certainly not in a position of leadership. And this all really comes down to that basic practice of, if you know the answer, don't worry about anybody else. Raise your hand and raise it high. If you don't know the answer, that's fine. Appreciate everyone who does and learn from them. And if I could set that pattern with those kids right there, and I can have the teachers, we can go back to that point of accountability, Gino, because the reason I didn't end up continuing with the schools was because of the teacher accountability. I'm not calling out any teachers on this. But there were some issues back then where they were having the kids sign in the student codes of conduct that they will not bring their cell phones into school. But yet they all brought their cell phones into school, because I would have every kid close your eyes, all the teachers close their eyes, raise your hand if you have your cell phone on. You don't worry, nobody's going to see. And then I would have all the teachers open their eyes and they'd see all the kids with their hands up. And you're asking the kids to sign their name to a rule, to a policy that the school district has, but you yourself won't follow it. This would create a whole number of issues between myself and the schools. And I just chose to take a step back. But anyways, going, I kind of digress a little bit there, I apologize. But going back to the actual formula, how to teach these kids to stop within their school, within their learning environments, within their school communities, to stop this cruelty. That's how it's done. Mm-hmm. To be the hero and to be the first one to stand up, because I just proved to all of you, others will follow. Everybody, because we want to be peaceful. We do not want that suffering. We do not, we're tired of seeing it happen. And this would naturally happen. And that was pretty much the model. That was it.
I mean, we all want to be recognized. We all want to be loved. Right. It's what the human nature is. And I appreciate that you went out and did that. That's amazing.
So what part of the problem that violence is around, though, is it just makes people significant. I mean, somebody can be significant by being violent, right? That's what Tony Robbins says. One of the six things, you can pull a gun out and put it in somebody's face. You don't need to be educated. You don't need to be smart. You're significant, right? So that's one of the other issues that we have going on. But I
but at the same time, you could be significant by being that one that stands up.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying, like, that's I'm just trying to give the counter argument to why there is violence and why there is aggression. And I agree with you. I don't think we want to. Just big shout out to Jake. I'm watching the Vikings show, right? There's two Vikings shows on, right? 8th century AD, brutal time. Everybody's brutal. But Ragnar, all he truly wants is to stop fighting and to settle. That's what he really wants deep down inside, even though the Vikings were brutal. That's what he ultimately wants. So I'm agreeing with you. I really do think we just want to sit there. We want to farm. The Vikings were first and foremost farmers. Then they were warriors, right? But they just wanted to be live in peace and farm their little piece of the land.
Right, I'm not going to argue with you, Gino. Look, I've been a fighter my whole life. Yeah. But I look to I look at it as, for me, it's a map, it's a model towards, in Japanese called, it's a principle very common in Japanese language called ikigai. Ikigai just means like your purpose. Yeah. And I'm able to take the energy and the challenges, the trauma, the suffering, and also the gifts that God's given to me with my physicality and my mental. And I'm able to find a path that works well for me, where I'm able to serve other people. I'm able to challenge myself with the art that I study, and I'm able to, you know, help build other people around me through martial arts. Mm-hmm. So the other path, though, is low-level social violence. I mean, there's a famous author that calls it monkey dancing. And this is one of the, in the personal protection space, this one particular author references monkey dancing as those fighters, because they're just acting in a very primitive level. Mm-hmm. They're only trying to get one of two things, which is a possession or information of some sort. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And once it's done, it's done. There's no long tail outcome that's positive. It only comes with suffering. I choose to go the opposite direction on that path. So
that's awesome. And again, it's your choice. And I think that's it's important to teach our children is that they can choose to stand up.
So I'm going to digress real quick. Me, my wife,
let's do it.
And the kids have been watching shows for like the last 6 months, right? Watching Burn Notice, watching Chuck and all these shows, right? And Burn Notice is a great show. If no one's watching, you should really watch it. But it's about a spy. And every show, he meets these bad guys. And my solution is he should just whack them at the end, right? Just knock them off,
right? And my response is the show would be over.
Okay. But ultimately, I would say to myself, I'm not going to put myself in that situation. I don't want to be a spy. I don't want to be around death and destruction all the time. But I could see it so clearly because you see the bad guy at the end. They show up 3 episodes later wanting to kill him again. And I'm like, Jewel, he should have just whacked them. You know what I'm saying? But I just think, when you're out there, you make those decisions that that protagonist in that show is his decision is he wants to be a spy. He's going to be in that world. So just be careful what your decisions are, right?
That's correct.
I was a chef. I was a real estate agent. More likely than not, I'm not going to be hunted. I'm not going to be targeted for death because that's not the space I'm in, right?
You're saying that your decisions affect your future.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So I'm not going to be out there, you know, being put in that situation. So for all the young adults out there, when you're looking for a career, make sure if you want to go into medicine, you're going there to serve others, right? If you want to go into the military, make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. So, and you're putting yourself in those situations. So I think it's important, but that's what I say to my wife all the time. Should have whacked them. And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, you should have whacked them, right?
So should have whacked them as an adult decision, Gino, but to kind of go back to what you said, if we're talking about kids, what we have to really communicate to our children is that if you want to live that aggressive life, if you want to follow those sort of like the template that we hear in a lot of like, a lot of music styles that like really promote violence, then you're walking on a razor edge. Like really you are walking on a razor wire when you live a life like that.
Yeah. I'm not saying that I would, I'm just saying in that situation, but I don't want to find myself in that situation. I'm trying to be proactive in life by not making those decisions.
I think we're a good team. That's correct. Because we have a good balance.
You sure do.
Let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsors.
Hey, Wheelbarrow Profits family, are you struggling with ways of teaching your kids about money and financial literacy? Gino, I think we have something to help them. Tell them about it.
We've been hard at work creating the Jake and Gino Youth Academy. The Academy takes a deep dive into good money habits, setting up a budget, investing, taxes, the difference between an asset and a liability, and so much more. This is a great opportunity to spend time with your children, to be their role model when it comes to money and investing, and learn how to set them on the right path to financial success.
If you want more information on how you can become the next Youth Academy member, visit www.jakeandgino.com/education to begin your journey to financial freedom.
As we like to say at Jake and Gino, people with financial intelligence can change the world for the better. Now, Adam, I want to get back to what are you looking to do in the future right now? Because you've got, you say you've got Connected Dads, you've got a YouTube channel, you're launching new programs. What are you looking to do in the future?
Well, thanks for asking that. I don't promote my martial arts school. There's a whole industry behind martial arts, and I'm sure you already know. There's a whole industry behind creating franchise schools and growing your getting as many students in as you can. That's never really been my way, but it has grown, especially as a result of COVID-19. My online program has grown pretty nicely. One of the things that I am working on and have been focused on for the last year is actually goes back all the way to 2006, and it's working with dads. Back then, I had noticed that there was only, I wasn't engaging with a lot of dads. Back when we would have classes of 40 or 50 kids, back then I was running 52 classes a week myself I was teaching. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that very, very rarely would I engage with a dad like yourself, Gina. I mean, I would mostly communicate with the moms. And I kind of, at first, I thought it was sort of a soccer mom thing. But as time went on, I realized a lot of these dads are sitting out in the parking lot and I couldn't quite figure out why. So at the time, my program manager, Pete, I said, Pete, I want you to record every dad that comes in here, and we created this little checklist in a three-ring binder, and every time I talked with a dad or a dad would come in to watch a belt test or whatever, mm-hmm. we would record it. Well, after 18 months, we sat down and we looked at those numbers, and I realized that I was only engaging with, out of all the students, 19% of their dads. It's a small number. Yeah. And I thought that was really interesting. And I wanted to kind of figure out what the commonality was with those dads. And it came down to this. They were either first responders at some point in their life, either retired or, you know, some type of career, or they had it in their background. Maybe they were EMTs earlier on. They had military experience. They were school teachers, was another one, school teachers, or they had martial arts in their background. But then there was also a specific sort of kind of like overachiever dads, kind of like yourself, Gino. Mm-hmm. And I mean that seriously. There were very few, I mean, maybe at the time, five dads that didn't have military, didn't have martial arts, weren't school teachers, but were great to talk to, but yet I talked to only a few of them over years and years of time. The majority of those, that 20% there, what we realized was that these were men who either had child trauma as part of their daily work routine. Police officers, firefighters had to show up and get children out of bad situations, or show up and see horrible things that had happened to children. Teachers worked in teams. They understood that other adults work for the growth and the benefit of children. Maybe it was the homeschooling, Gino. I don't know now that I'm thinking about it. But the rest of the dads I never spoke to. And I tried to create all these different programs over the years. I had this focus program where I'd invite the dads in and teach them how to work with their kids and help their kids become better martial artists. That failed. I had all kinds of different programs specifically geared to the dads. Well, finally, I realized that maybe what I can do is, and this came from specifically from one dad. I won't tell his story right now because I don't want to waste all your time. But what I did is I created a program where I didn't want to be the trainer. I wanted to train dads how to teach their children, because the children come to the dads. Dads are a first child's blanket of security. I mean, yes, mom, mm-hmm. but dad is the security. Mm-hmm. And those dads need to stay in that role until the children are fathers themselves. And what I discovered was that those men, I mean, God bless them, mm-hmm. but they felt some level of intimidation coming in and engaging with me. I would oftentimes, in the whole marketing thing, I did not want to send Julia home with my DVD and my martial arts school stuff, because I knew there was a guy there that was going to look at it and no, I don't like this. It's because it's another guy that his wife had just spoken to at a private place. And this is a guy that does this exotic art, and he's strong, and he's got black belts. Mm-hmm. And I don't want that. I can do this. Mm-hmm. Like, really, you know. So I realized that what I need to do is develop some type of program where I could work with a community of men, of these dads, and train them how to be that role, how to make sure that they're able to teach their children to have what it takes when it counts, so that their kids can come to them looking for those lessons. And yeah, of course, you know, martial arts is great. But when we talk about personal protection, we talk about family safety, when we talk about loss prevention, teaching your child what to do if they actually do get lost in the woods, or if they do get lost in an urban setting, if for small children, I mean, imagine if when Sophia was 4 years old and you were at you know, Danbury Mall, or you're down in the city, and all of a sudden you look right, look left, and she's gone. Is she equipped with what to do? Yeah. Have you taught her that?
No.
And then last resort situations. What does mm-hmm. happen if a child gets stuck in a car with strangers and the back doors are locked and she doesn't know how to get out? Yeah. What does she do? Do dads have the answers for those questions? So what I wanted to do is create a program for that. That's what I did last year. Mm-hmm. And it's a training community of specifically around men. But I also want to bring one last thing forward about this. You could teach all of these things all you want, But unless it's balanced with the internal work that a young person has to do, unless martial arts is balanced with internal work, then you're only going to end up with a fighter. You're only going to end up with someone who may be strong, may be able to punch and kick hard, but at some point, it's going to end in pain, trauma, and suffering. It might be 3, 5, 10 years down the road, but if that's the direction they're going in, it's a direction of breakdown. So I also want to train those dads on how to meditate properly, not interfere with the practice of faith or spirituality, but how to internalize and release anxiety and tension. So that's kind of the work that I'm doing right now with my program, Close Quarter Dad.
Close Quarter Dad. And they can find that online.
Yep. CloseQuarterDad.com.
Awesome. You're not intimidating at all, by the way.
Thank you, Julia.
Well, I'm being sarcastic because when we first started going to you, my kids were terrified of you. You were afraid to be late. Adam's going to come out in his bare feet in the snow. He's going to, he used to do that. He used to come walking around in the snow with no shoes on. But then as we got to know you, you're a big teddy bear. And so the kids are finally comfortable and loved hanging out with you. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Any final words, Joel?
No, this has been an amazing podcast. You're a great storyteller. That story about Dwyer is incredible. And I have to tell you, I've never actually heard it. So I really appreciate you telling that story. Beautiful.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I think that I appreciate being able to tell it a lot more.
Yeah.
So I just give out any of the other information. Do you want to give out an email address so people can get a hold of you or?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, anybody can go over to closequarterdad.com and find me there. And I'm not selling anything. Mm-hmm. There's no program yet. I have a YouTube page that I just launched. All my videos and lessons are there. I have a whole personal protection program that, again, is based on teaching dads, teaching them how to communicate to their children. Now, the personal protection needs of a 5-year-old child is much different than a 5-year-old little girl is much different than a 16-year-old boy.
Right.
So we have different discussions that are specific to those ages and those genders. But what I do is I talk about it, but then I have one of my dad's teaching their children. Mm-hmm. That's what we have over YouTube right now. My goal though is to have training programs for dads and to create a robust community of parents. They can reach me there, Gino. They could hop over to my YouTube channel and support that. It's brand new. And if they're interested in my traditional martial arts, then they can just find me on YouTube. Just Google my name, Adam Mitchell. You'll find me.
Good. Well, listen, we want to thank you for being on. And we're live on Facebook right now. So when we sign off, you guys, anyone wants to throw any questions in the channel, we'd
absolutely
love to answer those questions also. So it's been an honor and a privilege to record you today and to ask the questions, because we've known you for a couple decades right now. Yep. And I just liked you. That's why I came in to
thanks,
talk to
Gino.
You. If I didn't like you, I would have stayed in the car, basically. You know what I'm saying? So being honest here. So it's been a great journey for me. So I just want to thank you for being on, and listen, let's continue to make it happen, right?
Absolutely. Make it happen.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Julia.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.